Hello and welcome back to the podcast that is always up to speed with Formula One here on the Overtime Media Network. Although we're not that anymore, but hey, whatever. This is kind of a relaxed show tonight. This is episode 249. And can you believe it? Since, well, let's be fair. I mean, Mark, since you and I partnered up at the end of last year, I think 245 of those episodes are ones that we did together. Anyways, welcome back. It's Monday. I was going to say June 1st, but it's actually May 31st. By the time most of you see this, it will be, or listen to this, it'll be Tuesday, June 1st, which is exciting. That means for us here in the Northern Hemisphere, that means that summer is only 3 weeks away. And sadly, if you're in the summer hemisphere, that means that winter is only 3 weeks away. So glass half full, glass half empty. So whichever way you want to look at it, but exciting. And also, we are broadcasting live on YouTube tonight. And Mark, just an FYI, just before we started, I said I wasn't sure if it would actually work or not, but I can confirm that the YouTube studio, that the live stream is out there. So that's exciting. We've been trying a couple of different things here, and it's going to be fun. So hopefully, we'll put this out on the Twitter feed. Hopefully some of you jump in. And basically what we're going to do is we're going to go over, like, the mailbag is bursting at the seams. Like every time we put the call to action out there, you guys respond big time, which is completely awesome. We love it. And hopefully we can get to most of these comments and questions and everything. If not, we might just bump some of them over to the show on Thursday night. But Mark, where do you want to start? This is kind of a little bit, well, not like there's a real strict format that we hold on the show anyways, but where do you want to start? You had this very impressive document that you sent me this afternoon. So why did you take it away?
Yeah, I appreciate that. And this is also very exciting. And I don't ever get nervous when we're recording a podcast, but just knowing that potentially we might have some people watching us kind of changes the dynamic and the atmosphere a little bit. And you know what? Shame on you, by the way. Last time we recorded an entire episode while I had a bottle of Windex within the frame of the webcam, and you didn't say anything. So a few of our eagle-eyed viewers definitely caught that. But you know, I think one of the things I want to call out, or one of the things I want to start with from a question perspective is, and this question I'm not really going to assign to a specific listener because it's been asked so many times. And we talked a little bit about Max Mosley during the last podcast, and we talked about his really important role with the FIA. And I think a lot of the questions from our listeners were really, what the hell is the FIA and what does it do and why is it relevant to Formula One? And I think the first thing that's really important to clarify here is that in North America, we're not used to the intrusion of international governing bodies in our sports. The NHL is the NHL. It manages the commercial interests of the team. It manages the product on the ice. The NBA is the NBA. It manages the commercial interests of the teams and the players, and it also manages the product and the officiating on the floor. And the same goes for Major League Baseball, and the same goes for the NFL. Formula One, and I think you'll probably have some things to add to this, but Formula One is very much like international football in the sense that Formula One, Liberty, effectively manages the commercial components of the sport. So enabling teams to join, managing the commercial enterprises, TV revenue, putting on races, working with organizers, attracting sponsors. But ultimately, the FIA is the international governing body of motorsport. And ultimately, the FIA is the body that comes in and institutes the championship, manages track safety, certifies tracks, helps to govern the evolution of the cars and the power units. Ultimately, it's very, very different than I think we're accustomed to in North America, whereas NASCAR is this fully contained entity that manages all aspects of the product. IndyCar is very much the same. It's a contained entity that manages all of the aspects of its product. Formula One is different, where you have Liberty, which effectively owns Formula One. It manages the commercial side of the business. But the actual championship and the safety and the tracks and ultimately the governance of the sport is managed through this international body called the FIA. Mark, I don't know if I missed anything, but I think I tried to put it in terms that would be a little bit more familiar to our North American listeners. Did I miss anything, or would you add anything to that description of the FIA?
No, I think you did a pretty good job sort of just summing up in a nutshell. I mean, I think that is one of the things that maybe when you're new to the sport, especially if you're North American based, is just that sometimes the way that these European based sports operate and function is a little bit different than what we're used to. But I think that you did a pretty good job of summing that up.
And I would think, yep. I would just say as well, and this is probably one analogy that most of our listeners are probably familiar with. International club football is governed as much by FIFA as it mm-hmm. is by the international domestic organizations. I think that would probably be the closest parallel, right?
FIA. I would think so. I think that would be a pretty good parallel to draw with it. I mean, each sport obviously has its own unique needs and structures and things like that. But just sort of on a like on a macro on a big oversight kind of level, I would say that that's a pretty good comparison to make. I mean, you have to remember too that when it comes to things like North America, I mean, you always hear that one term tossed about. It doesn't matter if it's the NHL, NFL, Major League Baseball, NBA, is always franchise, right? And Formula One is a little bit different because all these teams are different. They're all independent. It's not like they're paying for a slot in Formula One. You know, it's not like, they do cap it at 20 teams, but sometimes that number has been bigger. Sometimes it's been smaller, but it's not like you see like a new team that was going to come into the NBA or something. There's like, say, a $500 million expansion fee or something like that. So that's another difference. That's one thing that I would add that's a little bit different. And of course, no collective bargaining agreements between, say, the FIA and Formula One and the drivers. And I think we talked about that just last week. I think you summed it up really nicely about how this secret society of like FIA approved lawyers have access to the secret vault in Geneva or whatever it is that can actually get in there to scrutinize and examine the contracts that the teams make with their drivers, which is again is really different, because I know for some of the outlets that I've covered Major League Soccer for before, that some of the most popular articles that we would have every year would be when the players union would publish the player salaries, because everybody wants to know, you know, what everybody else is earning, right? And those always were really quite popular articles. All right, so what is the next item up? I know we've got this big one here. I think you had some questions just about the show format as well, did you not?
Yeah, I do. And this is a question. It was a really good question that we got from @DonnellyB, Bobby Donnelly. Question for you guys. If you don't do the pod for money, why do you have ads? And I think this would probably be a really good question for you to kind of speak to.
Yeah, so that is that's a good point, and certainly I completely understand that one. So the reason that why we have ads is there's a couple of reasons. Number one, we do this 100% for fun. You know, we both have our 9-to-5 jobs, which are fun. Sort of in a different way, as fun as a 9-to-5 job that can be. But basically, we have a network that we're part of. And, the other show that I did, we did it for years. We paid basically everything out of pocket. And when it came to this podcast, the first couple of years, I was paying for all the hosting fees and anything on the back end out of my own pocket. And then I had the opportunity to join up with this media company. And so basically the ads help pay for the back end stuff, or the hosting fees and a lot of the stuff that we pay. It's not a lot. Anything that gets left over, unfortunately, you know, I'm going to have to wait another year to buy another Ferrari. It's just the way that is. But, joking aside, anything that gets left over, it's quite modest. It's, it goes onto my Starbucks card. But basically the ads, they help pay for the production costs because the hosting costs. And, I'm grateful to have them, but I think that some people had said, well, hey, if you had like a subscription service and the opportunity to do something via Patreon or maybe even Apple, Apple Podcast now has a premium service. I mean, that's model that, if people are interested in that, where they get like an ad fee free or feed, then, I'm totally up for looking into that, because, a lot of shows that I listen to as well and enjoy, they all are sponsored by, they have their advertisers, and it can be disruptive. I completely understand that, but at the end of the day, this can be a bit of an expensive hobby, so there's a bit of a there's a bit of a trade-off, let's just put it that way. So seriously,
you summarized it perfectly.
Yeah, I mean, seriously, if you guys if you're up for that, if you want us to start like a Patreon thing or maybe some sort of subscription service, just like a couple of bucks a month, we'd be very much be interested to hear from you. Send us a tweet at @ScooteryF1Pod or email us at ScooteryF1Pod@gmail.com, and we'll see if there's any interest. And by by all means, we can certainly do something with that. And just to the quantity of ads is the contract that we have. They specify, you know, every so many minutes, you know, we have to give the, you know, break, just like, you know, traditional TV or radio or whatever. So it's just part of the deal. So that is what it is. And, you know, hopefully next year I'll be able to buy that Ferrari, but I'm not counting on it just yet anyways.
I'll just add as well, and I think a lot of our listeners know this, but I was part of a podcast that we did for a couple of years, for 2019, 2020, called Flash F1. And I can definitely speak to the costs associated with standing up a podcast. I think sometimes there's this perception that you can do a podcast by buying a $40 USB mic, and for sure you can.
Yeah.
If you want to do something that sounds sophisticated and it sounds professional, the costs add up quickly. And you're talking about multi-channel interfaces, you're talking about licensing music, paying a commercial company to create a logo. Like, those costs add up very quickly. And yeah, I think sometimes people might have an appetite to absorb those. And I did with Flash F1 for a little while, but ultimately it gets to a point where you just have to weigh the pros and cons. Is it worth continuing to absorb these costs for the sake of the fun? Or is there an upside to potentially onboarding a sponsor who can help offset some of those costs so you can keep doing what you love without taking money away from some of your other passions and hobbies and family as well? So I think you did a really great job summarizing that one.
Cheers. All right, let's go on to the next one. The first thing I hate to do is just after, you know, answering a question about, you know, commercials and ads and stuff like that, is dive into a commercial break. So let's try to push it a little bit more, you know, let's answer another question or two before we get there.
So here's one from Jeff, and I really thank Jeff for sending us this message, because I think one of the things that we keep talking about is we want to do a really good job of interfacing and interacting and empowering our audience to be part of the show and be part of the culture. And he kind of put us on blast here, and I really respect the way he did it. So, and I quote, "Hey guys, just listening to the new podcast, I think you really missed the mark on the PED subject. From my personal experience,
right,
it's not about blood doping or recovery. The most used drug is in racing is Adderall, and it's used to enhance focus. The giveaway is the pinpoint pupils. Most guys get around the test because it's pretty simple to just get a prescription for it. It's everywhere in racing." So I want to address this one because, one, he's absolutely right. We did absolutely miss the mark. And I think sometimes when we talk about performance enhancing drugs, we think about things that are designed to help aid recovery, that are designed to help increase bulk, all those kind of pieces that we would associate with Major League Baseball and things like that from a North American perspective. But one of the things that has been very, very common in sports across North America and in North American motorsport racing or motorsports in general is the use of, I think, what are often casually referred to as greenies or amphetamines, which can be extracted commonly from Adderall. And these are tools that are designed to help with visual and mental acuity. So it's not necessarily something that's going to help with mass and aid recovery, but it's something that athletes have been using for years or decades in North America to help with focus. And this helps with baseball when you're talking about focusing in on a pitch or staying focused on the mound. And from a racing perspective, when you're in that hot, sweaty cockpit for an hour or 2 hours, racing lap after lap after lap in high intense racing, it's something that's designed to help dial in your focus. Now, it's not something that's necessarily been attributed to modern F1, but I did find a quote from Sterling Moss, who's openly admitted that in his days of racing, amphetamines were a very, very, very common part of the sport. And mm-hmm. I can speak from personal experience, having seen and been around it in sports here. It's still very common in team sports at the amateur and the college level in Canada and the United States. And I know it's very common in amateur and semi-pro stock car racing and karting. Whether it's prevalent in Formula One, I don't know, but absolutely, Jeff, great call. Amphetamines are absolutely a big part of sports and motorsports, and I think hopefully they just haven't penetrated Formula One.
You know, it's funny too, because I think that last week when we addressed this one, it sounded you had to go immediately. You had to drag Barry Bonds into this. It's just like, it sounds like we have a bitter listener in Pittsburgh, which I think you elicited quite a reaction. I forget who sent the original message, and that was kind of funny. I thought, what a great Twitter handle, @bitterinPittsburgh. I don't know if that's a thing, you know, not to make light of it, but of all the great sports connections you could have made with Pittsburgh, you had to go for Barry. Barry Bonds. I mean, why not the Immaculate Reception or something like that? But anyways, all good in the end. But that was a bit of a funny moment. I never expected you to go in that that direction, but also a great call too on the Adderall on that. And yeah, we totally overlooked that one. Okay, well, you know, let's not prolong the inevitable. Let's take a quick break here. And when we come back, we're going to go back into the mailbag. That's what we're going to do all night. Well, maybe not all night, for the next little while. And we'll do so in just a moment. So don't go away. We'll be right back.
Passion, drive, and patience. The formula for winning championships is also what keeps your ride or die alive. eBay Motors has everything you need to maintain your vehicle and level it up to peak performance. Superchargers, roof racks, exhaust kits, LED headlights, and more. Whether you're into speed, power, or style, eBay Motors has you covered. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you'll always find exactly what you're looking for. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, your part is guaranteed to fit your ride every time, or your money back. Because with eBay Motors, you're burning rubber, not cash. With all the parts you need at the prices you want, it's easy to make your car the MVP and bring home huge wins. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
All right. Well, welcome back to the show. Okay, Mark, where do you want to go now? There's still quite a few. There was a couple of comments in the mailbox itself. We can do that a little bit later. Why don't we just keep running down the mailbag that's all bursting from the tweets?
So I've got a couple of questions, and I think you would probably be a great person to answer these. So
sure.
The first one is, how did you get into Formula One? And this is a common question that I get from a lot of our listeners, especially mm-hmm. Gen DTS folks, which to be honest is pretty much all of us at this point. And the second one is, and this is a really great question, because I think one of the things that people are excited about in 2021 is, as COVID restrictions start to get lifted and more people start to get vaccinated, more and more people are going to have the opportunity to attend a Formula One race. And that's exciting, because so many of our listeners and so many new Formula One fans really only came on board last year or this year, and they haven't had the opportunity. So suddenly there's tens of thousands, if not millions of folks that now have the opportunity to go to a Formula One race, and they're excited to do so. So the first question is, one, how did you get into F1? And the second one is, what should we know when attending an F1 race, and what are some best practices for race day?
Okay, well, from my point of view, you know, or for my story anyways, my dad is English, and he was a Formula One fan. I mean, I grew up and Formula One was there. I don't particularly remember how it was broadcast way back in the day. I seem to remember growing up as a kid, there was like maybe like a condensed like Grand Prix on CBC at the time. I don't remember like exact. So this would be like the mid to late 80s. And I mean, from the 90s on, it was on TSN, which is now LinkedIn and hooked up with ESPN. And we get the Sky Sports feed, and it's been that way for a good number of years. But yeah, so I mean, I grew up with that. It was always there, and that was a cool thing. And my dad had tons of pictures that he took at places like Silverstone and Brands Hatch, and you know, told all these stories about, you know, these amazing drivers that we've all heard about. I mean, you mentioned one just now, Stirling Moss. My picture that my dad had of Stirling Moss actually just sitting on the bookshelf behind me. But you know, Jim Clark was my dad's one of my dad's favorites. Graham Hill, and you know, we sort of parlayed that into the 90s when his son Damon was racing for Williams, and then became a world champion back in 96. And it's just always been there. I mean, I mean, I'm a big sports guy anyways. I love most sports, hockey, baseball, basketball, soccer, hockey, you know, go on and on and on. But Formula One has been, it's always been there. It's always been, I'm just completely fascinated by it, just every single, you know, aspect of it. And it's so funny too, when you look at it, just the way that the sport evolves over time and over the years. And it's funny too, because I think I mentioned it a month or so ago. I went back and watched, I think it was the 2009 Australian Grand Prix. It was 2009, because I wanted to go back and take a look at that that memorable season when Braun GP came out of nowhere and just completely surprised everybody with this amazing car that was so dominant. And it's funny. I mean, the cars look, I mean, number one, they're smaller, they're narrower, they're shorter, you know, narrower wheelbase and everything, and longer pit stops because they had refueling back in the day. And it's funny. I mean, it just I don't want to say it looks clownish, but it looks a lot more chaotic than Formula One does now. I mean, especially when we have like, we live in the era of the sub 2 second pit stop, which is absolutely mind blowing. But I'm going to throw it back to you now, Mark, before we answer the second part about best practices for races. How did you get into Formula One?
It's interesting. So my family is British, and I grew up in the UK. I actually, to be fair, I kind of bounced back and forth between Canada, the UK, spent a lot of time in the US playing team sports. But when I was really young, I used to spend the summers with my grandparents, and every single Sunday, we would watch Formula One. And it's funny because I realized the other day, at one point, we started watching Indy as well. So after Nigel Mansell went to Indy in 93, mm-hmm. we started watching Indy as well, which is how I came to know with the Canadian driver, Paul Tracy. But I used to watch a lot of Formula One with my grandparents, and they were huge, huge fans of the Williams team and Nigel Mansell. So I have a very soft spot for the Williams team. And I've had the opportunity to go to the factory Same. A couple times yeah. in recent years. I think the other piece too is my dad wasn't necessarily a Formula One fan, but he was a huge motorbike racing fan. So growing up, he would build Nortons and Triumphs and Tritons, which were kind of like the cafe racer hybrid. So I came up in this kind of culture of motorsport, and it was really probably the last 10 years why I've kind of leaned back in. But yeah, once again, it really came from family, and it was something that I inherited just because motorsport is so deeply entrenched in British culture in a way that I think is probably a little bit difficult for a lot of North Americans to imagine. And I think the second question then, and I'll answer this one first because I'm already speaking, but in terms of an F1 race, every F1 race is different, and every track has very different rules about conduct and what you can bring into the track on race day. So my recommendation is certainly do your homework, because if you're going to somewhere like Austin or Silverstone, when you enter the track, you can go in through any gate and you can basically walk the entire outer perimeter of the track. You can bring in food, you can bring in drinks, you can bring in cameras, you can bring in camping chairs, you can bring in flags, you can bring in banners. It's very much like a music festival, whereas other tracks have much, 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 much tighter security. Some only allow you to restricted sections of the track. Some will only allow you direct access to your grandstand. Some won't allow you to bring flags, banners, and many won't allow you to bring any food or drink at all. So just do your research, because your experience is going to vary. And if you're attending a race in Western Europe, regardless of what you think the weather is going to be like, bring a rain jacket just mm-hmm. in case, because you never know how quickly the weather could change. But I would say do your homework and plan accordingly. And if you can bring food, I would always advise it, simply because track food quality can vary and it's extremely expensive. So if you have the opportunity to bring a cooler, have some fun picnic, it'll make the day a lot cheaper, and you can still soak in the atmosphere without incurring a lot of the costs. And I think the last piece would be as well, and we'll talk about this a little bit later, don't wait till race day to buy your merch, because it's absurdly expensive at the track. I mean, it's absurdly expensive online, but you can save a little bit of money if you buy it in advance.
Yeah, and when it comes to choosing where you want to seat or sit in the stands itself, I mean, sometimes there's a general admission and stuff like that. I mean, you can just go and basically take a lawn chair or a blanket or something like that, much like you do when you go to the beach. But I mean, certainly you want to pick somewhere where I think you get like a good view of the track. I mean, we were talking about it last week about the Nürburgring, where we sat way back all those years ago at the bottom of the track in the hairpin, which is great because you want to try and pick somewhere where you're going to get a good view. I mean, of course, you're going to pay the most money if you're sitting across from the pits at start finish, but I mean, you're going to see a lot of action in the pits. I mean, the paddock club above the pit lane, that's kind of a different level altogether. But when we went to Barcelona, we were sitting on the pit straight, but just by the pit exit. So we could see, we had a good view looking up the pit straight for the start, because you got that really long run down into turn one and through that series of corners there, turns one and two, and then up into turn three. But also what happens, the way the Barcelona goes, is it folds back in on itself. So the cars would disappear into turn three, and then they come back into turns four and five, and then six, and then you'd see them kind of in the infield there. And so you kind of get to see a good portion of the track. So you want to try and get a good view, you know, if that's in your price range, because obviously Formula One tickets, regardless where you're going, is pretty pricey. But that would be my my tip. And then of course, if you're picking a race, you'll pick somewhere that is interesting. I mean, one race that I'd love to go and see would be in Japan at Suzuka. you know, because I've got a fascination just in general with Japan and Japanese history and Japanese culture. I mean, we went to Spain and Barcelona. Like I say, it's a fantastic city. I mean, we were there for an entire week and actually a little bit more than a week. So we kind of had our days at the track for the qualifying, for the race, and for everything else. And then we still had several days in and around the city to visit and to do the tourism thing. So those would be my tips.
Next question for you, moving the salon.
Yep.
From at Sahil, JJ underscore one, Sahil, maybe you guys could schedule a Twitter quote unquote space to try and interact more with fans of the show.
Cool. Kind of like a Twitter podcast or a twadcast, if there's such a thing. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's a part of the fun of, doing something like this is being able to connect with other fans around the world. That's one thing I enjoyed doing with, my other work covering Major League Soccer and just the people that I was able to meet, not just locally here in Vancouver, but also the opportunities and just the kind of the cool things that people would send us, you know, especially from like expats living in different parts of the world that grew up in Vancouver, for example, and we're still following the local teams. But Formula One's different because, I mean, we literally hear from all four corners of the globe, and that's really cool. I mean, as I go now to the to the live stream, we had a couple of messages here. Shao Kan, he said, a fellow F1 fan from Canada, Nigerian Canadian, said Lewis got him into F1. And I mean, that's, another person there. He says, he goes on to say that Brazilian win was epic. I got into F1 back in 2009 and went back to binge watch F1 2007, 2008. I've been hooked since. And then he also finishes off by saying Monaco is the most boring track on earth, which kind of echoes my sentiments from a couple of weeks ago. But it's kind of cool. I think that's a great thing. I mean, the thing that the way that it's kind of working, if you're interacting via Twitter, you're going to get the other mark. If you're sending emails, you're going to interact with this mark. So if you guys want to do that, we can certainly set something up. But the one thing that's a little bit difficult is, being based here on the West Coast and literally getting people connecting from all over the globe is finding a time and a date that works for everyone. So that's the only challenge. All right, well, you seem to have frozen on me for a second. Here, there you
I'm
go
back.
You're back. Okay. It seemed to have a little bit of a connectivity problem there. So the live stream is kind of glitching, although Falco Fire said on the YouTube stream that we're coming through loud and clear. So at least one of us is.
And kudos to him. He's been a fantastic follower. One other question then. So moving on, and this one I'll take quickly. So this one's from at Anthony Potato. And I apologize if I pronounced that wrong. I love this question. I saw you just liked a couple of my tweets about LeBron, and I don't know if it's just about social engagement or whether you actually like the dunk, but there's actually so many similarities between LeBron James and Lewis Hamilton, both on the court track and their image off the court. So I'll address this one quickly.
Sure.
I think that's absolutely an accurate statement. And please feel free to add on anything if I miss this. I think absolutely both of them have assumed this role of social justice warriors. I have a great deal of respect for both of them. I think LeBron James, unfortunately, in North America, comes under quite a lot of heat for his advocacy. And I think that's partly because in North America, there's this chunk of sports fans that lean into sports as an escape from everything else, from politics, from social issues, from financial issues. They lean into sports as an escape. And I think sometimes folks don't necessarily appreciate or respect when athletes bring social causes onto the court. For me, I think this is a good thing, and I'm glad they do it because I think they have a platform that they need to leverage to help address these kind of social disparities and these social opportunities within the fabric of our society. Lewis does it as well. And I think it's important for Lewis because he exists and operates in a very different realm than some of these NBA players and some of these pop stars and some of these musicians, in the sense that historically his audience has been predominantly, I shouldn't say predominantly white, because obviously kind of the roots of Formula One are deeply entrenched in Western Europe. But I think the traditional fan base and the typical corporate base still resides very much in Europe, no matter how much it's made strides in the Middle East and in parts of South America and parts of Asia. But I think what Lewis has been able to accomplish over the last couple of years, just in terms of bringing this message to the forefront of Formula One, has been important, because if he wasn't doing it, nobody would be doing it. And he's exposing an entirely different audience to a message that may not have been exposed to that message otherwise. So I just, to wrap this up, totally agree. He's taken on very much the same position as LeBron James in terms of advocating for social justice causes in a way that some folks might not. And to be fair, I think if he didn't do it, he would be criticized. He does do it and he's criticized. I think he's just leaning into his heart and doing what he feels is right. And I have a great deal of respect for that.
Yeah, it is interesting. You know, I've heard kind of both sides of the story from different people that have got in touch over the past number of weeks and months, and it seems to be kind of split down the middle. Some people are saying this is sports, kind of leave the social justice things and politics out of it, and some people are very much, yeah, I think it's great that guys like Lewis and LeBron are using the exposure and the platforms that they have to bring exposure to these things. And some people, I've actually heard, even say that some people just kind of like roll their eyes whenever Lewis kind of, starts addressing these things. And I guess it's just a personal thing, because I think for a lot of people that sports is very much like an escape from the real world. So, you don't want to ignore all the nasty and horrible things out there, but I can understand that some people don't like seeing it dragged into that, just because, it is, Formula One, basketball, whatever it might be, is just that escape from the everyday, the heavy stuff that we have to deal with. So, I think it's very much a personal reaction to whoever it is, right?
Next question, and I don't mean to move on quickly, but we just have so many questions. We've got to keep the pace going, and I'm typically the one that kind of slows it to a crawl. But the next one, and this is a great question from Steve Williams at Steve Fred Will. Can you guys do an episode on the upcoming regulation changes for 2022? I know there's a lot to it, but maybe an explanation for dummies. So I haven't talked to you about this yet, but I know we've been planning some content for the summer break. So for those of you that are Formula One, we have a four-week summer break that we have to look forward to, quote unquote. I think that might be a really great show to do during the summer break, effectively a look forward to or a primer for the 2022 regulation changes. I don't know if you agree, but I think we've got a couple of folks that would probably be really happy to join us and kind of walk us through what's going to happen for 2022.
Formula 101, enroll now. I think it's a great idea. I mean, basically, when it comes to all the changes from kind of like a big overview, I think I'm kind of familiar with those, but it'd be really good to kind of like dive down and really go down that rabbit hole and really dig into that nitty gritty about what is going to change. Because I mean, the sport is going to look fundamentally different come the start of next year. I mean, it's a watershed moment. It's that just one of those milestones where they, that comes once, basically every generation, where they really just reset the entire sport. I mean, except for the power units, which are frozen for, several years yet. But I mean, the cars themselves are going to be fundamentally different. I mean, we did see those mock-ups now that would have come out, about 2018, 2019 or thereabouts? Yeah. That when they, because they had this working group that I think was headed up by what was it, Ross Brawn and Rory Byrne, some of these guys that have been around for a long, long time and were uber successful during their Formula One careers, to look at some of these different areas. I mean, the one big criticism is just the disturbance that the aerodynamics that these cars create behind them, and how it affects the fact that they just can't get close enough to actually overtake. And that was one thing that they really wanted to look at. So they came up with all these different areas that they wanted to address. And that was basically the, I guess the starting point for where these regulations were going to come or where they were going to go, I should say. And then they had these mock-ups of what the cars looked like, and they looked, awesome. But what they turn out to be in reality, I mean, is going to be, it's going to be a surprise. I mean, I think that every year that I've done this show, and we certainly did it this year, where we did our March Madness, where we had a bracket of the best looking car, which was a lot of fun. But it's going to be really, exciting to see what these cars look like. And are they going to end up looking similar to what the cars are now, or are they going to look similar to what the mock-ups were when they released a couple of years ago? And then, you know, we'll see, and we'll take it from there. Hey, Mark, I just want to take another quick break here where we're at that that time again. And when we come back, I'll let you go to the next question in the mailbag, and we'll do so in just a moment. So don't go away. We'll be right back. All right. Well, welcome back to the show. And Mark, where do we want to go to now? Again, there's so many great questions and points that have been sent in to us. What do we do? Can we use darts? Or
I want to just quickly add something to that last question, and I promise I'll be quick. But I think for the benefit of those listening, because I know the summer break's a little ways off, I think the one thing I want to clarify about the 2022 regulations is they're really designed to do a couple of things. They're designed to reduce costs because they want to continue to make Formula One sustainable for the current teams and continue to attract new teams. They're designed to increase parity, and they're designed to, as a consequence of both of those things, improve racing on the track. So what we're ultimately going to see are cars that will feature far less technical innovation than we've seen in the past, because cars will be far more standardized than they are today. Today, engineers and designers have a relative amount of freedom in designing their cars. In the new world in 2022, they won't have that same degree of freedom, at least not in the way that we've been used to it over the past. So the Formula One of 2022 is going to be somewhere between F1 of today and the current IndyCar championship, where the cars are very, very much spec cars. So expect to see some simplification, but ultimately, if it creates a better racing product, that's a good thing as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
Cool. So I've got another question for you here. Okay. Let's take a look here. I dig the pod. So this is from iSoup Auto Art, Zachary Carroll. I dig the pod, and this is a question I get all the time. Have you guys thought about setting up a fantasy league? I think it'd be fun. FantasyGP.com is my personal favorite, but any would be fun.
Yeah, you know, actually, I did set up a fantasy league, I think 2 years ago, but you know, honestly, I've just let it slide by the wayside. I mean, it's just, you know, when I was doing the show on my own, I mean, it just basically came down to producing content and, putting it out there. When it came to all these extra things, like, you know, managing the social media, doing thing like a fantasy league, I just didn't have enough time for it. But again, now that we have more hands, this is more hands. I mean, an extra set of hands. That's certainly something that that we should look into, because it's always fun, right? You know, and I'll be honest. I mean, I'm a pushover when it comes to any sort of fantasy sports, because I am terrible. I'll set up my team, my league, whatever. I set up like for the first weekend of the year. And then like 4 months later, I'll go check and I'm like dead last. And I'm like, well, I'm not going to move up now. So why bother? So yeah, I suck at those sort of things, but that shouldn't stop the rest of you guys from having fun.
You know, I agree. I have a bad tendency to start fantasy sports and check out after 2 weeks. But I think given how big this community is coming, that I think it'll be something exciting to retry next year. And maybe we can lean into somebody in the audience, one of our listeners, to take on the responsibility of setting that up and managing it. And then we can use the show each week to talk a little bit about leaders and those that are participating and results, and maybe set up a prize as well. So I think come this winter, that's something we'll look at. Another question here, and this is one I want to take because it's one that I'm super, super, super passionate about. I'm just going to dig this one up. So this comes from at Vintage Viewport, Christopher Letty, who, by the way, has his own podcast about collectible toys. He asked about F1 collecting. This is a really interesting topic because I think the first thing to kind of speak about right now is, for a number of different reasons, the globe's experiencing something of an asset bubble. There's a lot of cash. Banks are printing a ton of money, and people are investing heavily in collectibles, whether it's trading cards, whether it's shoes, whether it's sports memorabilia. And I've been monitoring this for a while. Formula One has kind of escaped this bubble, but I think as Formula One becomes more and more popular in North America, you're going to see more and more folks in the US buying into F1 memorabilia. And there's a couple of different things. So I've got a few pieces here that I kind of want to show everyone. So if you're watching on the YouTube channel, if you want to go back and look at this later, one of the most popular pieces of F1 memorabilia are 1/18 scale model cars. And there's a couple of really big brands that produce these. One is called Mini Champs, which makes $200 to $300 models. And another is a company called Spark, which makes resin models. And the resin models are far more detailed, but typically they'll go for $300 or $400. The other piece that's very, very popular are these 1/2 scale helmets. These come out every year for each of the drivers or most of the drivers. They're about $150 to $200 Canadian, about $100 US. But again, very, very popular. This is one of my Lewis helmets. I think this helmet is from 2015, but you can see we actually got him to sign this one in person a few years ago. So this one's very, very special to us. But this is another type of memorabilia that's very, very popular. And then finally, and this is what I think is going to go absolutely bananas in the US, is car parts are very, very, very popular and very accessible. You can buy entire Formula One cars, typically without the power unit, but you can buy every imaginable part. You can buy wheels, you can buy side pods, you can buy wings. This is a gear out of the gearbox from a 2005 Williams car. And when I bought it, it was still wet with fluid, which is crazy. And the interesting thing about this part is you can actually see the serial number. So when these parts go into cars, they track every single part by a serial number so they can go into their database and they know, hey, this gear's been on a car for 200 kilometers. It needs to be replaced. But I think those are going to be very popular. And one of the things I learned about the other day as well is there are now Topps trading cards for Formula One, which I had no idea existed.
Yeah, you know, it's funny too, because Ben Fuller sent an email, and he's just talking about that as well. He says, hi, I saw the latest tweet on the F1 Top Sports card. I'm a big F1 fan and got into the hobby a year ago. I enjoyed it so much that I recently started my own online store dedicated to F1 sports card.
Wow.
I think that's interesting. I mean, we kind of like, North American culture. I mean, sports cars have always been a thing.
Totally.
You know, I'll be 100% honest with you. This is something that kind of slipped underneath the radar for me. I mean, I've got a collection. I've got, several, diecast, the 118 models. I don't have any of the helmets. I've got a vast. I probably have about 7 or 8 hats. I've got a couple Mercedes. I got some Ferrari. I've got some Williams. I've got a Jordan, kind of spanning some of the different races that I've been to. I've got a Williams one. I've got one that I bought at the track in Barcelona for the Spanish Grand Prix, just a sort of souvenir Grand Prix hat. So, I've kind of got quite a few different ones. But, cards said that's interesting. And, I could see something like that being quite popular in North America. I mean, you see sports cards all the time. I mean, my son, he likes to collect hockey cards. I mean, that's something that I did when I was a kid. But the Formula One cards, I think that's really actually kind of cool.
Yeah, and to be honest, it's something that I didn't know existed. And I've been watching the bubble around sports cards for the last couple of years. And I think recently there was a Wayne Gretzky rookie card, a mint condition 10 grade Wayne Gretzky rookie card that went for a little over 3 million US. And they've accelerated in value almost 1,000-fold in the last decade. So it doesn't surprise me that Topps is leaning into Formula One trading cards. It's something I'm now curious to get my hands on and hopefully get my son into. But yeah, I thought that was interesting. And hopefully that maybe answers your questions a little bit. But F1 collectibles, they're huge in Europe. They haven't made a real imprint in the United States. But I think as the popularity of the sport grows, I think all of those different things that I spoke to and you spoke to, whether it's hats, clothing, merchandise, model cars, model helmets, and car parts, I think are going to, and potentially NFT as well, although I don't really yet understand what that is, well, I think become much, much, much more popular. I've got another question for you, and I think this is when...
If you I just want to add one more thing. Honestly, when it comes to the F1 merch, the one thing that's a real big turnoff for me is just the price point for most things. When you're looking at like $60-$75 for just even like a ball cap, plus the shipping just to get it to North America, it just really kind of like turns me off. I mean, occasionally you'll see some merch. I've got a Red Bull T-shirt that my wife saw at like the Puma outlet store out by Vancouver International Airport. It's just like they had Ferrari and they had Red Bull, and they only had I think the Ferrari was all like the ridiculous size. It was like 2 or 3 XL or extra small or something like that, whereas they had like a large for the Red Bull. And there isn't too much that you see too often. Although the other week I was outside just barbecuing and I saw this guy walking down the street wearing a Red Bull T-shirt. Like not just a Red Bull T-shirt for the brand, but the actual for Red Bull Racing. COVID notwithstanding, I felt like running across and at least giving the guy like a high five or a hug or something, just because, quite often, I feel like I'm this lonely man on the Formula One island. So I mean, every time you see somebody else local that's a Formula One fan, it's just like instant connection. But anyways, I rambled a bit. Next question, please.
That's awesome. Awesome. So here's a great, great question. So this one comes from Renee Cairns, our Renee. Hey, Mark, one comment on your podcast. Often you guys talk about the young talents in terms of drivers. We mostly then talk about Lando, Lance, Charles, but we seem to forget that Max is only a month older than Charles. Is he such a veteran already in our view? And how would you rate a 22 to 23-year-old Max now against a 22 to 23-year-old Lewis?
Yeah, isn't that...
Wow, great question.
Great question, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think that we do like view Max as a veteran because he came into when he was like, 17 or something absolutely ridiculous. I mean, he's just uber talented.
Totally.
I mean, there's no question about it. I mean, Lewis very much the same thing. What was his first year, 2007?
2007 as a 22-year-old?
Yeah. Yeah, something like that. So a little bit older, obviously. I mean, spent some more time in the junior formula. I mean, the one thing that was different is Lewis had a more competitive car earlier in his career than Max did. I mean, Max, he had that, I guess you could call a bit of an apprenticeship with Toro Rosso before, fortune really worked out in his favor. And Marco and Horner really took that leap of faith do the Kvyat Verstappen switcheroo. There, I got out eventually back in 2016. I mean, he won his first race in Spain and hasn't looked back since. Is, recorded quite, a few race victories and podiums since then. And, I mean, yeah, I think in terms of raw talent, I think that at both ages, I think that, there's a lot of parallels between them. I think that that Lewis is maybe going to get a little bit more of the, you want to say cred, if you want to call it that, just because he was world champion in his second season. And I mean, he beat Fernando Alonso, who was his teammate at McLaren at the time, to do so. And, basically yanked the world championship out of Felipe Massa's hands. I mean, poor old Felipe was, world champion for 15, 20 seconds or whatever it was. But, I think that for me, I'd say that they're pretty equal.
Yeah. It's very interesting stories, and I would encourage people to look into this. So you're right. Lewis was a little bit older, so he went through the Mercedes Academy, whereas Max went through the Red Bull Academy, which means early promotion into Toro Rosso, or at least it was known as Toro Rosso at the time. Hamilton's first year in Formula One in 2007, we talk about how toxic the team environment was at Mercedes in 2016 with him and Rosberg, but it was nothing compared to the toxic cesspool that was the entire McLaren organization in 2007. He was in a situation where, as this rookie driver, he was competing with Alonso, who'd made the move over from Renault, who was at that time a two-time world champion and had every expectation in the world that he was going to be the alpha driver. And there was constant adversity and friction between the two of them. The team was embroiled in one of the biggest scandals in the history of Formula One from a cheating perspective, and ultimately an $800 million fine. Like, I would encourage people to go and look at 2007. So what Hamilton was able to do to persevere through all of that, he finished second in 2007. He finished behind the champion, ultimate Kimi Raikkonen, by a single point. And then he won in 2008, I guess, by a single point or two. But what he managed to persevere through in those years to win at that rate was absolutely absurd. So I want to give him a lot of credit for that. But ultimately, you can't also dismiss what Max Verstappen was able to do in terms of winning a Formula One race in 2016 as a teenager, when most of us were working on getting our driver's license, is just incredible. But a great, great, great question.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Hey, Mark, before we go to the next question, let's, we have to take our obligatory break. And then we'll come back and we'll dive back into the Twitter mailbag. So don't go away. We'll be right back. All right. Well, welcome back to the show. What's up next? I mean, these questions and comments are awesome. I don't know if we're worthy. I'll take what, obviously I'm going to, yeah, we're worthy enough.
I think you're going to like this one. It's technical, but not too technical. So this one comes from at Zach to Adams, or Zachary Adams. And I quote, sure. I was reading in a few articles online that they were saying that changes of 2025 could be as dramatic as in 2014. So 2025 being the year when potentially we could see a new power unit. And he goes on to say, as in 2014, when they went to the hybrid V6, it would be interesting to see if they would go to a hybrid with a sustainable fuel source. that seemed to be the main reason Honda pulled out and why companies like the VW Group haven't bought in. I think this is a really, really interesting question.
Yeah, absolutely. And well, I mean, that was basically Honda's big reason for pulling out of Formula One, was saying that because, you know, we're going all electric, we want to focus on our road fleet and that transition. I mean, I remember even just, you know, was it 2-3 years ago or something like that? It was Volvo that said that they were going to freeze development on all their internal combustion engines by, you know, with the ultimate goal that they were convert their entire fleet to all electric. I think it's sort of sometime 2024. Five-ish or thereabouts. I mean, that trend is well underway, and it is really, really interesting. I mean, you know, they have started to talk about what these engines are going to look like post-2025. I mean, these aren't going to change over the next several years. I mean, basically what we've had since 2014 with some developments, minor developments along the way, you know, they're here to stay. So, I mean, what happens in 26 is a complete unknown, but they've really been hinting at it over the last couple of months that they're looking at these sort of like really exotic sort of biofuels and things that, you know, or exotic and sustainable fuel additives and stuff like that. So I think we've kind of speculated about it before, that we kind of think that that's maybe where the sport is going to go, is that they're going to kind of kick this can down the road as far as they can, while the, you know, I guess, you know, the development on the electric side gets done behind closed doors, or maybe in a different racing series like Formula E. Because, you know, if they were going to go convert Formula One to all electric right now, I mean, the performance just wouldn't be there. I mean, if they could get the cars to perform and do the different or the same things that they can with the internal combustion engines, regardless if it's normally aspirated or the turbo hybrid V6, you know, that would I think that's ultimately where they're going to go, and I think they're going to wait on that until electric power can replicate what we're getting right now. That's just my own gut feeling.
No, and I think that's a really great summary, and I think my head's in very much the same place. I think I was listening to a podcast, probably winter 2019, winter 2020, and Ross Brawn, the managing director, motorsports and technical director for Formula One. And just so you guys know, Ross Brawn is one of the most important people in modern F1 history, and I would encourage you to go and Google Ross Brawn. But he was on a podcast, and I think it was Beyond the Grid, but this same question came up, and they were asking about the future of the power unit and the future of Formula One. And he was very, very, very defensive when being asked these questions. And he's absolutely adamant that some sort of fuel source will continue to be part of the F1 formula. And I think what he was inferring was ultimately that it would potentially be a synthetic fuel source that would be coupled with an internal combustion engine and some form of hybrid infrastructure and pieces like that. So I think there's still a runway for synthetic fuels. And I don't know that we're going to see an all electric Formula One series in the next 10 or maybe 12 years at the very, very least. So I think there's some runway there, which leads and segues perfectly into the next question from Greg at Greg's Place 512. And I'm going to take a stab at this question. I'm going to get you to keep me honest here because I might get this one wrong. So he says, huge fan of the pod, got hooked to F1 after going to the first Austin GP, which would have been back in 2012. Could you help explain how the hybrid battery recharge or whatever the flashing red light is works? Okay, so I'm going to take a stab at this. So at the core, because I love the technical side of the sport, but I'm going to try and simplify this, and I'll probably get it totally wrong, and you're going to be snickering at me. At the core of the power unit package is a 1.6 liter V6 internal combustion engine. Bolted to that is a turbocharger. So it's a forced induction V6 engine. So that's not unconventional, and a lot of road cars have forced induction internal combustion engines. Where Formula One gets a little bit unique is they effectively have a double hybrid system. So they have a component called the MGU-H, which bolts onto the turbo, and they have an MGU-K, which basically bolts onto the braking system. The MGU-H functions by extracting wasted heat from the exhaust system and pumps it back into the turbo. That way, they help to eliminate turbo lag, which allows the turbo to spool faster when the car's taken off of the accelerator. So one of the really cool things about a turbo is when it spools up, it compresses air, it pumps more air into the internal combustion engine, which allows the car to pump more fuel in and produce more power. The challenge with turbos, though, is that when you get off of the throttle, when you get off of the accelerator, you're pumping less exhaust into the turbo itself. So one of the things that MGU-H does is it captures that energy, it can hold on to it or put it into a battery, or if the car is taken off of the accelerator, it can pump that energy directly back into the turbo. So the turbo is spooling full time. So there's almost no turbo lag. So when the car does go back on the throttle, that turbo is already spun up, it's already spooling, and it's ready to go. The other thing that the car does is it has an MGU or K for kinetic, which basically captures wasted energy from the braking cycle. So heat that's generated under braking. And that power can be put into the MGU-H, or it can be put into the battery. And the battery stores about 160 horsepower worth of energy. So all in all, it's a very, very, very complex system. And there's a whole bunch of other technical pieces about the fact that the MGU-H and the MGU-K actually capture electricity on an AC current, but the battery is a DC current. You have to have a component to convert the two. But ultimately, just think about this. You have a 1.6 liter V6, you have a turbocharger, and you have a double hybrid system that helps capture energy that are from different parts of waste. So waste from the exhaust and waste from braking. I think at a high level, does that capture it? Did I miss anything else, or should I just post a Chain Bear video so everyone can get a better explanation?
Well, the link to the Chain Bear video is probably the best, but I think, you basically nailed it there. I mean, it really is, fascinating that technology that they are able to do what they can do with these power units. And let us not forget that when this was introduced in 2014, we had three engine suppliers at the time, Mercedes, Renault, and Ferrari. And then when Honda came back in 2015, I mean, they wanted to get back into it, but they were so far back on the development curve because, I mean, these engine suppliers, I mean, they've been working and developing these engines for a significant period of time prior to 2014, and Honda came into the game a little bit later on. And, unfortunately for them and for McLaren, who they were supplying engines to at the time, that, they were basically developing the engine, in situ, right? Like actually in the season. And it was just, it was painful to watch. And then, of course, we had all the hysterics from Fernando as well. And, a lot of and things like that. I mean, one that specifically stands out was the Russian Grand Prix. I can't remember. What was it, 2015 or 2016? His car basically failed on the formation lap. And then, his engineer said something, well, can you restart the car? Can you try something? He said, nope, I can't do anything. Why don't you come out here and try? really, it's just like, it was one of those things that just kind of stuck in my head. But I guess that's Fernando being Fernando. Okay, next question.
So here's one that I think is a good one for you to take. This is from Harshvardhan, at Harshvardhan or Harshvardhan Yadav. Also, just a small request from people who, and I apologize, I'm sorry, I probably did not get that name right at all, so I sincerely apologize. Just a small request from people who've just gotten into F1 like me. Would it be possible if you guys could discuss some of the more classic races events throughout history? So it's funny that you asked this question because one of the reasons that Mark and I actually started talking was probably a year ago, maybe more than a year ago, we actually started talking about standing up a separate podcast entirely that would look back at historical events and seasons and races in Formula One. And I think, and maybe I'm getting ahead of myself, but I think that's something that you and I have talked about doing during the off season to continue to create content or potentially do during the off season.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, there are so many great moments and storylines to talk about. And I did a couple of things like that on my own a couple of years ago, specifically in the off season. One that I did, I mean, this was stuff I'd done in advance of like the Christmas break and New Year's when, everybody, like I don't do anything at that time except sit around and eat, which you tend to do at that time of year. But one year, I think I did a special episode on the Williams FW15B, or sorry, the FW14B, that real classic, dominating car from the early 90s. I did another one on Dan Gurney from who's a very very famous American racing driver from back in the 60s, and then in Formula One, and then of course went on to do so many other amazing things, on and off the track, not just confined to Formula One. So I did do something like that, and they're fun. You know, they're actually a lot of fun to do, because I mean, as much material as there is to talk about each and every week, not just not just the races, but just the normal news cycle in Formula One. There's always something fun to talk about, but certainly there's a lot of good ones. I mean, I think we had a mailbag question about a month or two ago. Somebody was asking for some recommendations, to go back and some of our favorite races. I mean, certainly Brazil 2008, when Lewis won his first championship, that was dramatic. Abu Dhabi 2016 with the championship on the line between Lewis and Nico Rosberg, that was another one. British Grand Prix, I think 1992 was one.
Yeah,
I think that was Mansell Mania. That was another one. Some of these, and sometimes it's fun too to go back and look at some of these. Like go back if you've got access to F1 TV, or say you can find like a highlight package on YouTube. You know, some of these races from the 90s and the 80s and the 70s and things like that. I mean, it's pretty cool to be able to watch some of those. So. Yeah, definitely. We've talked about it. I think we will do it at some point.
The only other two I would add as well, and I think there's so many great races, and we could break this out into seasons, into dynasties, into ownership runs, but I would advise as well, check out the 2010 and 2011 Canadian Grand Prix. They were both great. Yep. The 2012 Abu Dhabi GP, the 2014 Bahrain GP, which we've talked about a lot, 2016 in Spain, 2018 in Britain, 2019 in Germany. That was crazy. And if you have the F1 TV app, most of these should be accessible for you, so you can spin these up if you want to learn a little bit more about F1 history. Another question.
Don't forget also Suzuka Japanese Grand Prix 1988. We talked about the Hamilton Rosberg. We talked about Lewis and Fernando, but an equally toxic relationship for teammates was in McLaren in 88. Title contenders Ayrton Senna and Alain Prost, and it came to tears at Suzuka at the chicane just before the pit entrance there. So that's another one that you should go and check out. And just before you go on, our good friend Victor Sum weighing in on the live stream here. He wants to know if he can be the show NASCAR insider. So I told him yes. I didn't want to say no and hurt Victor's feelings. So here we go. We got a NASCAR angle coming as well.
It's Victor's fault that we even know each other. Years ago, he's like, hey, did you know my friend in Coquitlam is also doing a Formula One podcast? Like, I thought we were the only ones in Canada, and like threw my desk in the air. So that was interesting. Yeah, so he was the one that created this very dysfunctional, I shouldn't say dysfunctional, semi-functional marriage.
Let's just say it's all Victor's fault. Let's put it that way.
Oh, absolutely. So this is one I'm super excited about, and I absolutely love this question. So this is from Pat at Pash the Pirate. It's from Grant. Hey guys, question for the next mailbag you guys do. And this is such a great question. What on earth happened to Williams? I'm new to F1 this season. I've been watching archived races on F1 TV Pro. Just finished the 2014 Bahrain Grand Prix, which we were just talking about a couple minutes ago, and Bottas, Massa, and the Williams were fighting for the podium. How did Williams go from that to backmarkers so relatively quickly, especially with the Mercedes power unit? Thanks, guys. Love the pod. So thanks for all the support. Love it. I think to kind of speak to the Williams challenges, you really have to go back to the 90s. So back in the 80s and the 90s, Williams was peak Williams. They won the driver's title in 80 with Alan Jones. They won in 82 with KK Rosberg, which is Nico Rosberg's father. They won in 87 with Nelson Piquet, 92 with Nigel Mansell, 93 with Alan Prost, who replaced Nigel Mansell when he went to Indy. They won in 96 with Damon Hill. They won with 97 with JV. They had a great power unit. They had fantastic suspension, maybe suspension that was a little bit too advanced for Formula One and ultimately had to be reined in. They were really at, sir, please.
Yeah, that active suspension that they had back in 91 or 92, I mean, that was ultimately banned, but they weren't the only ones. They came out with it, and Lotus came out with something similar at the time. But you're absolutely correct. I mean, they had not only a great power unit, but power units. They had Hondas, they had Renault. I mean, they were the engines that everybody wanted. If you were going to be the best in Formula One in the 80s, you needed the Honda. In the 90s, it was the Renault. And they had a great design team that was headed up by Patrick Head. I believe Adrian Newey got his start at Williams. I mean, he's now the head at Red Bull. I mean, Newey's record in Formula One is epic. I mean, he's done so much. I mean, he got his start there. But, you know, the thing is I don't want to say that the decline was sharp, but it was. after the mid-90s, after Damon won his and after Jacques won his world championship, and then they both went on to do other things, and they moved to teams. Then you had Ralf Schumacher and JPM, who are good drivers in their own right, but I don't think that they were necessarily, you know, world champion material. But then again, the cars at that point weren't necessarily, I mean, they had BMW power at one point, but they, you know, they haven't, you know, they didn't win another race until what, Maldonado won in Spain in what, 2012. And that was a bit of
a fluke.
It was a fluke. I mean, you know, it was a fluke that he actually was able to keep it on the track for as long. I mean, his legacy is somewhat, you know, a little bit, you know, not the brightest, let's put it that way. But I mean, they'd kind of been kind of in that best of the rest, but when they fell off, I mean, that it was sharp and it was dramatic. I mean, it was all in that sort of the aftermath of 2016. I mean, they had Massa, they had Bottas. I mean, they were kind of like in the best of the rest and the constructors. I mean, they'd be good for a podium here and there. I mean, you know, we've been a little bit you know, critical and sometimes maybe a little bit too harsh on Bottas, but I mean, you know, I mean, that's a bit of a different discussion, but I mean, he's done a great job at Mercedes, but I think he did also a great job when he was at Williams as well. But the thing is, I think that when, you know, after 2016, I think when Patty Lowe went there, I think they just tried to get too radical on what they wanted to do with the car. And ultimately, I think it hurt them more than it helped them. And, you know, once, you know, they went that far off the track, and then, you know, they had issues, I think, with the funding and the finances. And it was just, they rapidly found themselves in a hole they just had no way of clawing themselves out of. And then after 43 years, the Williams family are out, and they sold their team to Darrelton Capital, who are now the people in charge. And there's some signs that things are starting to turn around, but whether or not we're going to see a McLaren-esque type revival, yeah, I don't know. Too early to say. I mean, hopeful. I mean, I have like a real connection to the team. I've tended to cheer for drivers more over the years, but I always have this connection to Williams because of Jacques, because of Damon Hill, because of Nigel Mansell. And, you know, those were the guys I cheered for when I was a kid, when I was growing up. And yeah, it's sad to see.
I have very much the same emotional connection that you do for very much the same reasons. I'm far less optimistic that they're going to be able to get out of this tailspin. And I think you're absolutely right. Like the decline happened quickly. So they win the driver's title in 97. They end up in 98 with a terrible Mechachrome rebadged motor that was already a year old. And they go in this terrible tailspin for the better part of the next 18 years, where at best they're middle of the pack. And I think if you really have to summarize some of the things that proved problematic for this team, is they continue to be a family-owned business in a sport that ended up being dominated by corporate giants. So they were trying to play in the same pool as these big boys that had unlimited resources. And to compound issues, one of the challenges for Frank and his technical directors was they absolutely insisted on developing everything in-house. So under Formula One regulations, there's a certain number of components that you can buy from other teams, and there's a certain number of components that you need to develop internally. They would try to develop everything internally except the power unit. And for a team that had minuscule or very, very few financial resources, they spread themselves very thin trying to build a component that they could go and buy off the shelf for less money and with better performance. And gearbox was one of those, brakes would be one of those things. So they continued to try to develop components inside. And then I think just the philosophy of the business was very problematic. This was a team that has historically had a very powerful technical director who would not delegate or empower his department heads. So ultimately, it was one person trying to dictate the development of the entire car. And historically, from 98 to 2016, you had a car that was typically significantly behind the rest of the field, especially in aerodynamics. Now, the listener asks a great question, like what happened in 2016? To me, 2016 was a fluke. You know, I think history shows that a lot of these teams, Honda wasn't yet in the sport, Formula One wasn't ready, Renault wasn't ready, but Red Bull had a good package. Ultimately, they just happened to be in the right place at the right time, and they had the best power unit coming into the new period of regulation. So they were very fortunate in 2016. What happened in 2016 and 2017 and 2018, so 2014, 15, 16, is The rest of the field continued to evolve and develop their cars. And ultimately, Williams wasn't able to do that because they were focusing on the wrong thing. They weren't focusing on aero enough. They were focusing on developing components and pouring resources and developing things that they should have been buying from other teams. And then ultimately, you made a great point. Patty comes in. He's like, this car is fundamentally broken. So rather than taking the evolutionary steps that they should have taken in the preceding 3 or 4 years to develop the aero, he basically had to blow the car up and start over. So it wasn't even kind of an evolutionary process. It was a revolutionary process. They had to catch up for 5 years of development overnight. Ultimately, they couldn't do that. And in 2019, they showed up late to winter testing. Patty leaves, the car's still broken. Like, this is a team that is not in a good place, and only time is going to help them. Now, 2022 is ultimately a really great opportunity because everything resets again except the power unit. So they've already got the best power unit, but you're going to reset everything else. So if ever this team has an opportunity to catch up, it's really going to be in 2022. So I know that was a very long answer that we both shared, but I think it does a pretty good job of summarizing what's been happening with Williams the last decade or two.
Yeah, well, the other thing is too, when they've had the the misfortune of losing their power units, it wasn't just an isolated incident. I mean, back in the late 80s, Honda yanked their engine supply and they ended up running Judd engines, and I can't remember what Judds were at the time, if they were rebadged Cosworths or something like that. And I think basically at the time, Honda was putting pressure to get Nigel Mansell out, and they wanted the Japanese driver in there. But Williams held fast, and they end up, losing those. And then that kind of bridged the gap until they got the Renaults, and then they went on to that. But I mean, that's sort of been, that's not unique to Formula One. I mean, we see teams change engine suppliers fairly regularly. I mean, we've seen McLaren go through, they're on their third engine supplier at the moment. I mean, 2015, they were running, they went for Mercedes, then they went to Honda, then went to Renault, and now they're back with Mercedes again. So, I mean, four in the last decade. But yeah, it's been a kind of a dramatic couple of decades for Williams. Hey, one final break here, Mark, and then when we come back, we'll dive back into things. We're going a little bit long, but we want to try and get to everything that you guys send to us. So we'll do so in just a moment. So don't go away. We'll be right back. All right. Well, welcome back to the show. So let's keep going, but let's keep an eye on the time now. you said earlier that you tend to be the guy that drags things out, I never say no, or I never try to slow you down. And once you get going, I wouldn't say drag me into it. I'm a willing participant. I'm always eager to go down all the rabbit holes as well. So what's up?
Okay. So here's another one for you. So this is from Troy at Snelly T. Hey guys, love the pod. DTS newbie here. And I have a more technical question I was hoping you could answer. And this is probably something we'll address in that podcast in the summer, but how were the overall car designs decided? For example, in 2017, all cars had that large shark fin for just the 1 year. Or next year, when the new car came, all the teams are given a specific template to follow. I've seen some non-official renderings of what the car will look like, and I'm wondering how that is known, or if it is just a random guess. So I guess he's asking, like, how do we know what 2022 is going to look like, but the last couple of years have kind of been all over the place? I've seen some non-official renderings of what the car will look like, or is it just random guess? Lastly, why don't we see any team show up with a crazy design like the six-wheel Tyrrell from 1976? Seems like Haas could try something radical in hopes of competing.
Yeah, well, they will have like the basic outlines, but that's why you'll see teams push the limits when it comes to their interpretation of the rules and regulations. I mean, this is a big discussion that we've been having over the past couple of weeks with the bendy flexible wings, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's not as dramatic as adding six wheels to the car, but I mean, that's the thing. I mean, there are the parameters which they're bound to design the car for minimum widths and heights and lengths and all, and minimum weights and maximum weights and all these. Well, I guess there's no maximum, but the minimums for everything like that. But they're always trying to find that advantage. And I mean, they're so detail oriented. I mean, putting the tape over the joints on the bodywork and polishing up the cars. I mean, because of a tenth of a second here or a hundredth of a second there, all these things add up. So I mean, they're always going to be trying to push the boundaries of what is and what is not allowed. And that's why periodically you'll have these technical directives that are issued by the FIA. I mean, there was this one on the bendy wings, I mean, a couple of years ago. The other one that immediately springs to mind was the power units, this whole saga and scandal that Ferrari got embroiled with that ended up with that that rankling decision, that secret agreement that they had with the FIA at the end of 2019. So, yeah, I mean, again, that kind of goes back to what we were talking about a little bit earlier on, is we really don't know what these cars are going to look like next year. I mean, and the thing that I find fascinating too is that, you know, there hasn't really been anything, any sort of like concepts that have kind of like leaked out there or speculations, you know. I mean, that's something that I find, you know, really fascinating, that all 10 of these teams, that everything is so locked down, so tight that, you know, that nothing's getting out there. And basically the only idea of what we have to look at is, like we were talking about a little bit earlier, is those proof, you know, these concept designs that came out when Formula One made the announcement 3-4 years ago, whatever it is now, that, you know, this is what we're going to in 2022, and this is what we expect the cars to look like. And, you know, we know that it's going to have a front and rear ring. We know it's going to have four wheels. We know that inside is going to be a 1.5 V6 liter turbo hybrid engine. And, you know, that's about it. But what, you know, how the cars are actually designed and what they end up looking to is just it's a big mystery. And also, that's you know, very similar sentiment from an email that I got from Mike Boverhoff in Michigan. And, you know, very, very interesting. I mean, you know, there's a second part to Mike's email here, just regarding some of the younger drivers. But, you know, it is interesting, you know, with these massive rule changes that are coming for next year.
The only thing I think I would add is we don't know what the cars are necessarily going to look like next year. But I think the one thing that we can predict, or at least that we know, is they're going to be very, very, very similar. Again, the concept, the formula has been simplified, so the engineers and the designers will have far less creative license than they do today. And I think one of the things we've seen over the past couple of years is the formula, the sporting regulations kind of give guide rails in terms of what you can and can't do, but there's a lot of gray area that the engineers and the designers can work within. And oftentimes these designers and engineers come to very different conclusions than other teams. And sometimes it's not as obvious on TV, but if you're in person and you see two or three different teams' cars next to each other, they're very, very different. Sometimes they come to the same conclusions. Sometimes they just flagrantly steal. But I think in 2022, they're trying to, in an effort to reduce costs and increase parity, they're taking that creative license away from the designers and the engineers, which is one of the things you need to do to reduce costs. It won't be as similar as Indy. So this is kind of the next question. So the segue is kind of perfect. But there is a question here about Indy, and this is from Hall & Oates. I've been thinking about this a lot lately. After looking at the comparison of the chassis in different eras, I have a bit of a radical idea. Similar to IndyCar having different aero packages for road courses and aero. So in Indy, so it's an awesome question. Indy is a very different sport in the sense that it takes place on ovals, it takes place on short ovals, and it takes place on road tracks. And for each one of those, they have very different aero kits. So depending on whether you're at Indy versus whether you are in Tampa on a street course, you will have a functionally different front wing and a functionally different rear wing. So they actually bolt on entirely different aero packages, different brake ducts, depending on where they're racing. Now, that said, these pieces are all identical. So the teams are all using the exact same aero parts. They're not designing them themselves. But I think from an F1 perspective, it's an interesting question. But I think if F1 is ultimately looking to reduce costs, having different aero configurations for different tracks is probably not something that they're looking to do. And likewise, at the same time, even though F1's kind of a combination of these dedicated circuits and street courses, they're not as functionally different as a super speedway would be from a road course. So in Indy, there's a genuine necessity to have different aero packages to make these cars functional and the different types of tracks that they race at. It's not necessarily the same in Formula One.
Yeah, it's Formula One's a little bit different in that way. I mean, they'll go to different configurations for higher low downforce, and then also the way that they're going to camber in the angle of the wheels or the toe in, toe out, and then the amount of downforce on the front and rear wings and all those different things. And then also you take into account the different tire compounds that the Pirelli bring for each race that are based on the uniqueness or the characteristics of each each track. So it's either going to be the harder set of tires in the range. They got five different tire compounds, so it could be, you know, the harder or the softer, or sometimes in the middle. But you know, I think I said it on the show last week or the week before. I kind of actually miss when a couple of years ago, when I know it got a little bit ridiculous when you had like the super softs and the ultra softs and the hyper softs. But I guess it is for people a little bit easier. You know, you got a hard, medium, and soft, and you have to use your prime and your option tires. You have to use the hard, one harder compound tire in the race itself. But yeah, I mean, certainly, like you're saying, I mean, having these different aero kits certainly would not fit in with this new era of the cost cap and keeping costs down. I mean, because knowing Formula One, there would be fluid dynamics, there would be wind tunnels, and all this modeling going around, and that would just send the costs not vertical, but it would send them up significantly for sure.
So I've got a couple more. And so just a couple, I promise. Some of these, by the way, I think we'll defer to a future show. So we have a couple of great questions about film and documentary from Luke Boyce and Carter Swan, which I think would be perfect to save for the future. This is a comment from Michael Stewart at Michael Stewart. This is less a question, more of a statement from a new fan, but fascinating. From this citizen in the US, what was and is appealing is that Formula One is the antithesis of NASCAR, which I am no fan. F1 is polished, has a pristine shine to it, and is associated with brands of luxury, Ferrari, Mercedes, Aston Martin, etc. But it also has deep storylines that are layered. The team framework of two drivers amongst a small number of teams creates drama and tension that plays well. This drama drew me in. I haven't even got into the racing part yet. Still, I'm learning the nuance of the rules and strategy. If they are able to play on these things, I think it will resonate with a larger US audience.
Yeah, I agree. I think that's a great point. My good friend Jorge, I mean, he's Mr. Soccer. I mean, he's just absolutely fanatical about it. And I was talking to him just last week, and he's into DTS as well. And he's just like, the sport is fascinating. And I'm just like, dude, I never thought I'd heard you say that. And of course, he's originally from Mexico City, and now he knew who Checo Perez was of before. He's not that far removed from Formula One, but he's just amazed at just the whole production of Drive to Survive, and just all the different nuances and twists and turns to watching Formula One. I said, okay, well, getting into DTS is one thing. What about actually watching some races now, my friend? So we'll see whether or not he makes the next step, or if he disappoints.
The next question, and it's really less of a question, but more of an ongoing conversation that Joe and I have been having. But Joe Santucci has some questions about tire management, tires in general. I think this is something that I want to save for the next time we connect with Tim Haraney, because I think he could probably do a really good job of talking about tires in a way that we can't, simply because he has experience driving open wheel racing cars. But I think the one comment for our listeners is, you hear all sorts of different things about tires. I think if you ever hear reference to a soft compound tire, the reference is really to the fact that a soft compound tire is stickier, but typically will last far fewer laps than a harder compound tire, which will be less sticky. The challenge is, whether it's a hard compound tire, a medium compound tire, or a soft compound tire, the tires need to be hot to activate the grip. And if they're not hot, they're not going to be grippy regardless. So tire management is all about, how long can I manage this tire? How long can I keep this tire useful? How long can I keep the grip? Because if I don't manage my tires well and I burn through the compound that is there, it means I have to pit unnecessarily or I lose grip. So we'll talk about some of these, but I think Tim might be a really good person to talk to us about tire management, right?
Yeah, absolutely. But one thing I will add to that is, when it comes to the softer compounds, they're easier to bring up to that sweet spot for the optimum operating temperature, and then compared to the medium and the harder compound. And that's why, especially when you get to some of these races where it's cooler, where the weather's not so good, it just takes that much more to generate that energy and generate the heat into the tire before especially those harder compound tires, to get it to the point where it's nice and hard and sticky and grippy in its own right. I mean, of course, the softer tires are also faster, because that's what, if you see the Sky Sports feed, they'll always put whatever they think it is, you'll have your soft tire, and then I'll say your medium tire will be plus point 6 seconds per lap slower, and then the hard compound might be plus 1.1 laps slower per lap. But of course, the harder it is, theoretically, the longer you can run. So, you know, you should be able to go further into the race. But I mean, we've seen at times that the cars, depending on the track and the weather, that sometimes, you know, what you think might be logical doesn't actually work out to be the way that you think. And then sometimes you think that the soft tires might be the way to go, and turns out actually the hard is. So it's just one of those things. But I agree, Tim would be the guy to talk to, and we'll have to connect with him and get him back on, because he could enlighten all of us, I'm sure.
One of the things you've probably seen when these cars are going in for pit stops is the fact that the tires are typically wrapped in blankets. Those are electric tire warmers. They're designed to start injecting heat into the tires before they're even put on the car to help get them up to that optimal operating temperature that you spoke to. And I think the only other thing to speak to as well is that if the sport wanted, and we've been there before, if the sport wanted, Pirelli could design some general compound tire that could run an entire race. The fact that we have a pit stop is in a sense, it's artificial. It's designed to add a little bit of excitement and intrigue and inject a little bit more strategy into the sport. But ultimately, and correct me if I'm wrong here, but I think the current regulation calls for one tire change per race, and you have to run two separate compounds on race day. So you can't switch from a soft to a soft. You'd have to go soft to medium, or hard to medium, or hard to soft.
Yeah, which is, you know, sometimes it's referred to the prime and the option tire as well. So
exactly.
We hear that thrown out as well.
That's all I got from Twitter. So there's some other great Twitter questions, but I'm going to save them. So if you didn't hear your question and I did commit to you on Twitter, I'm going to put these aside, and I promise you will answer them in an upcoming show. But that is it for Twitter tonight.
Okay, I got one more, and that was that one email that I was just talking about from Mike Boverhoff in Michigan. He says, "Hi guys, thanks for the work that you guys do with the podcast. It's really helped me understand the sport as a Gen DTS. I have a nagging thought about Danny Ricciardo. He seems to be the right driver at the wrong time. He got to Red Bull after the change to hybrid motors. In a different time, he probably has the talent to be an F1 champion. Maybe he gets there, but he is running out of time." You know, that's a great point. You know, I mean, I think that first season of DTS was pretty interesting, because it kind of detailed and documented his whole switch to Renault. Because when that happened in 2018, I was on holiday. I was sitting outside the hotel, and I was just sitting there scrolling through. Now, this is pre-pandemic, so this is pre-doom scrolling on social media, before that was a thing. So it was just scrolling back in the day, and then I happened to see Danny's. I can't remember if he put it on Instagram or Twitter. I mean, it was probably both, but you know, it was right in the start of the summer break there, because going into Hungary that year, he was basically, they were saying that, yeah, the contract, new contract with Red Bull is basically a done deal. We just have to dot all the I's and cross all the T's, and it's basically a done thing. And, like everyone else, I was probably not the only one that was shocked that he announced that he was going to, basically take at best a lateral move to Renault, and, more likely a step backwards. And, that only lasted two seasons, although, all credit to him, he managed to get on the podium a couple of times last year. And I think going to McLaren is, I think it's a step in the right direction. But I think somebody else had also sent this email, or sent, maybe had sent a tweet about this too, about the basically the same thing, that he's maybe running out of time. I mean, he's early 30s now, and I don't want to say that the clock is ticking, but certainly, kind of has to make you wonder. I think that he has the talent to do it, but not necessarily has he had the car to do it at the right time. And whether or not he ultimately gets there, that's a great question. I don't know.
My thought on this is, I'm going to steal this from another listener, again, my good friend Dan Randy on Twitter, but he made a great comment the other day about the fact that Ricciardo's transition to Renault was a little bit easier, because he was going from a Renault power unit to a Renault power unit. In this case, he's going from a Renault package and a Renault power unit to an entirely new chassis and a new power unit. I'm still confident he's going to be able to turn the season around. My frustration with Daniel Ricciardo is less even about Daniel Ricciardo, but it stems back to Red Bull. My sense is, and I've grown increasingly frustrated with Helmut Marko and Christian Horner over the past couple of years, mm-hmm. because they've clearly demonstrated an inability to nurture and to develop young drivers. And we've seen, even the last week, the treatment of Yuki. We've seen the treatment of Alex Albon and Alexander Gasly, the fact that they had Carlos Sainz and they let him go. They don't seem to be great at nurturing young drivers. And they had the optimal driver pairing. Imagine a driver pairing right now of Max Verstappen and Daniel Ricciardo, and you are absolutely in contention for a constructors title. And they had that, but they couldn't manage the relationship between those two drivers. And I don't doubt for a minute Daniel Ricciardo left because he didn't feel that he was effectively supported in that organization back in 2018. And that's why he left for Renault. And I think he's spoken as much about that in the preceding few years. So my frustration is Daniel Ricciardo should still be with Red Bull, and Red Bull should be better for it.
Yeah, absolutely. I will not dispute that, in any way. I think you nailed it. And, ultimately, I think that, Checo Perez is, that sort of similar driver. Whether or not he can deliver the goods the way that Danny Ric did is, that's the $64,000 question. I think that, I didn't get a chance to look into it, but I think that story was out there, this week that they're not going to talk contracts with Checo before the summer break. So, is that ominous? Maybe not. But certainly, I mean, each and every time he gets into that Red Bull, he's absolutely auditioning for next year. But again, I think that you nail it when you say that they're not great at nurturing younger drivers. But, Checo has been saying some pretty good things about Marco, saying he's pretty upfront. He's supportive. He's telling him what he needs to hear, not necessarily what he wants Marco to tell him and sugarcoat it. That's fine. But, they need to be patient, I think, on in one regards when it comes to either developing a young driver. I mean, let's face it. I mean, they kind of, I don't want to say fluked when it came to Max. I think they knew what they had in a commodity.
Totally.
It's just whether or not would he be able to live up to the potential that he had. But certainly when it came to Gasly, I think they pulled the pin on him a little bit too soon. And then the same with Alex Albon. It's just like, if you're going to give these young drivers the seat, it's either you leave them in that development team at AlphaTauri or Toro Rosso and let them develop there. I mean, Gasly, I think that since he's gone back to Toro Rosso or AlphaTauri, I'm starting to get mixed up here, they just haven't had that time to develop. And then there's a comment here on the YouTube feed from Tasimba checking in from South Africa. He says, but if not Checo, then who? Yeah, great point. I mean, if you can't get it done with one of your own prospects, and then you've got a journeyman, guy that's been in the sport for over a decade and has been a pretty handy driver everywhere he's been. I mean, he won his first Grand Prix last year. Then who are you going to, who are you going to replace him with? And then moreover, who's going to want to go there? it's
totally,
it's going to be one of those places. It's like, you get that number two seat at Red Bull. It's almost like it's cursed, or it's where careers go to die. So
I totally agree. And I just want to add for context, because I know our listeners enjoy this. Mm-hmm. In his time with Red Bull, Daniel Ricciardo had 27 podiums and 7 race wins. He finished third in the Drivers' Championship in 2014 and third in 2016. He clearly has the credentials. He was familiar with the team. To me, it's just such a shocking, unfortunate turn of events that they weren't able to put him in a state of mind where he felt comfortable with his future, and he felt comfortable knowing that that team had his best interests in mind. And again, we've talked, and I've heard other podcasts and other analysts speak to something of a toxic, uncertain culture within that team. You have a guy that's run 7 races with you and has taken almost 30 podiums and finished third in the Drivers' Championship twice, and you let him go. You can't convince him to stay. The whole circle that we've seen with Sergio and Alex and with Gasly, that was all a downstream knock-on effect of the fact that you couldn't keep Daniel Ricciardo happy. And I think that's just an absolute shame and a pox on that team. But I think that's being dramatic, and I know we've got to wrap it up.
No, I think nicely done. Anyway, so yeah, that's all I got as well. So, if you're good, I'm good. We had a message here from my brother. Why do you guys suck? But we'll leave that to another show. And then I'm going to have it. No, he didn't send that. But anyways, a bad joke to finish the show. Why not? Right. Have to have a little bit of sense of humor. Anyways, guys, thank you so much for all the awesome tweets and emails. We really appreciate it. As we say, I mean, being able to interact with you guys online or offline is awesome. And, I've seen quite a few people checking in on the live stream. So, we'll try and do this again on non-race weeks, or maybe we'll make this a regular thing. We'll see how it goes. But certainly it's kind of cool to be able to interact real time. Anyways, of course, we're going to be back in a couple of days with the regular weekly show. We're going to preview the Azerbaijan Grand Prix that's going to go at the Baku City Circuit this week. So we're back to racing, which is always exciting. And until then, if you want to get in touch, of course, Twitter's the best way to do so, at Scuderia F1 Pod, or via email at scuderiaf1pod@gmail.com. And that's it. On behalf of myself and Mark Hamilton, thank you for watching. Thank you for listening. Have a great week. And we'll talk to you guys again in a couple of days. Bye for now.
Welcome to another round of Boardroom or Miroboard. Today we talk retrospectives with Agile coach Maria. Let's go. First question. You've spent 2 hours in a team retro, but the only input you've heard is Dave's. Boardroom or Miroboard?
Boardroom. In Miro, Dave can't hog the space because everyone can add thoughts anonymously, online at the same time.
Correct. Next. You need the team to act on feedback fast, so you turn all those retro notes into Jira tasks instantly.
Miro all the way. And I can assign those tasks to teammates.
You're nailing this. Now, you see hundreds of sticky notes from the retro. A real mess. But you organize them into 5 themes in just seconds.
Miro, I basically get back an entire hour when I use its AI tools for clustering.
And she's done it.
Join over 60 million people running actually enjoyable and actionable retros in Miro. Get your first 3 boards free at Miro.com. That's Miro.com.